Other women on the block work too, Wyatt says. Tennyson runs that boutique on Main. It's called Les Jardins. Have you been there? At the mention of Tennyson, Yolanda's expression hardens like cement.
We haven't really been on Main yet, Doug says.
Wyatt rubs Yolanda's arm as if it's a lamp that might contain a genie. She won't look at him.
We should head outside for dessert, Wyatt says. Yolanda makes these Nutella squares you won't believe. No one eats just one.
That does sound killer, Doug says, with an overblown enthusiasm that tells me he's sensed the sea change between Wyatt and Yolanda, too. He stands up.
You want me to handle Sadie's diaper?
You know I've got the magic touch. She won't even wake up. I hand her over, feeling suddenly exposed, like I've lost my security blanket. Yolanda gives me a high-wattage smile.
It's been great getting to know you, Kat.
You too, I say, returning the smile.
Thanks for the booze, Wyatt says, and the talk.
It's so good to have people like you on the block,
Yolanda says, fixing her gaze on Doug and then on me in turn.
You know, normal people.
What were Niels and Ilsa? Yolanda and Wyatt walk out, and I want to wilt back into the couch. We came, we saw, we conquered. I avoided any major social faux pas. That's enough for one day. Doug carries Sadie upstairs to the changing table, and though he does have a talent for minimal jostling, she wakes up with a wail anyway. I hear him soothing her expertly. He's just the dad I hoped he would be. And I think I always sensed that and was attracted to it from the first time we got together, even before I knew that I wanted to be a mom myself. They come back down, and Sadie's in a fresh purple onesie that reads, Daddy's Girl.
Seriously, Doug, I say.
He smiles.
You dressed her for round one. I get round two.
I'd put her in a cute print sundress, not a onesie from the five-pack his mother had given us, which we made fun of when we'd found a pink You Go Girl in the mix. But no need to split hairs. Should we call it a day? I ask.
Did you even see the dessert table? I'm having at least three of those Nutella squares.
He lifts Sadie high in the air and then drops and catches her. It's a game she finds endlessly delightful.
Come on, introvert. It's only one more hour.
I don't know where he gets all his energy. Right now, he's practically vibrating with it. He was recently promoted to senior market research analyst and has been working longer hours, then coming home and still getting in his quality time with Sadie. While the raise couldn't have come at a better time, there's no customized Tesla in our future.
Are you okay?
His question reminds me that we're in this together. And if it's not okay right this second, it will be soon.
You don't have to go back out if you don't want to. I get that this stuff is hard for you.
I feel a tsunami of love for him. For them. Doug and Sadie. They're my life, and it's good. Let's go. When we step outside, the party is still in full swing, though the laughter is more raucous, read drunken. On the curb across the street, the kids are lined up like a photo op. Seemingly according to height. Their feet in the street, their knees practically touching, while they eat ice cream cones. I see that there's an actual silver cart nearby with a pinstriped umbrella, and an adult I haven't met yet is scooping. The heat seems to have skyrocketed, and I'm feeling a little faint. Maybe I do need to quit while I'm ahead. Doug is wearing Sadie in the Bjorn, so I could just go inside and let them carry the torch for our family. At parties, Doug likes to outlast everyone. He says you get the best dirt during cleanup. I'm looking around, trying to decide where to insert myself, when I notice something. Where people were talking in groups earlier, now they're talking in pairs. Cross-gender pairs, for the most part, and no one is with his or her own spouse. They're standing closer than seems customary. Coy smiles, flirtatious laughter, the occasional hand on an arm. I've been around the block, so to speak. I know what chemistry looks like. What is wrong with me? It's daylight. Kids are nearby, and everyone is happy.
more than happy. There's no hint of jealousy, no sense that people feel their partners are behaving in an untoward fashion, and indeed, whatever touch is happening is totally PG. But I think of the note. Is this what it means to be neighborly? If so, maybe I'm not. I don't want anyone looking up at Doug the way, say, Tennyson is looking at Raquel's husband, Bart. Or for that matter, the way Raquel is looking at Tennyson's husband, Vic. It's just conversation among neighbors, among friends, I'm sure. Yet I'm still feeling slightly off-kilter when a petite woman in well-fitting jeans, a white tank top, and a chunky necklace approaches me. I haven't seen her before. She's got thick, straight, strawberry blonde hair that falls a few inches past her shoulders, which are as freckled as her face. I hope it's okay that I'm crashing the party. She has the best smile I've seen all day, and there have been a lot of smiles. I live over there. She points to the huge, and I mean huge, corner Tudor on the 1700 block. It looks new, too, like maybe the owners bought up two houses and knocked them down in order to build it. I'm Andy Prager. I'm Kat Ingalls. I don't know what makes me do it, but I lean toward her. I'm sorry. I'm so tired. I feel like I'm going to fall over. It's overwhelming, meeting all these new people, especially when they're so nice. Despite the heat, I feel a chill. Why especially then? Because you can't just put in an appearance. You have to small talk for hours, and that is the definition of exhausting. She glances back toward her house a bit furtively. Listen, I can't stay long, and I don't want to hold you up. I just came to invite you over to our place for dinner. What night works for you? I can't say no. Not that I want to, exactly, but it's hard to know precisely what I want. I feel disoriented by her directness and by her charisma. It's like I have no choice. Tuesday? Perfect. My husband, Nolan, he says welcome too, by the way, works way too many hours, so it's a treat to be able to tell him he has to be home early on Tuesday. And my son, Fisher, is about Sadie's age. I think we'll all get along famously. Another brilliant smile. Fisher's not with her, so she must have a nanny. Of course she does. With a house like that, she probably has a whole staff. A maid to clean, a butler to answer the door and mix martinis, and a nanny for Fisher. How else could the mother of a four-month-old look so fresh? Is 6 o'clock okay? She asks, and I nod. Can't wait for Tuesday! She sashays back to her house. Doug comes over, and we're both transfixed by Andy's retreat. It's not like she's the prettiest at the party. That title would go to Tennyson or Yolanda, but she's got a way. Your eyes follow her entrances and her exits. You want to know what she knows. That's Andy, I say. She wants us to come over for dinner on Tuesday. We watch her go inside the Tudor.
I have to agree with you, he says.
I raise an eyebrow questioningly.
About the garbage. Can you imagine a woman like Andy inviting us to dinner with a garbage mountain in front of our house?
He kisses the top of my head, and I lean into his shoulder. One of the neighbors shouts, "Get a room!" and everyone laughs, myself included. I realize the clusters are back. No more coupling with other people's spouses. Tennyson, Raquel, and their husbands have become a convivial foursome. It's like I'd imagined the earlier configurations, the flirting, the scent of sexual possibility. It's a block party. A perfect summer day with tipsy neighbors who truly like and trust each other. The AV is utopia, and so egalitarian that you can even talk about money. No matter what you have, you're good enough. Andy Prager just sought me out. It's a brave new world. As Doug and I stand together, surveying, the tide starts to turn. It happens that quickly sometimes. One influential family says their goodbyes, and then everyone's packing up, packing it in, leaving in droves back to their houses. We're not in party mode anymore. We're in get-shit-done mode, the story of a parent's life. A party is an organism with a natural lifespan, and this one is expiring quickly.
Let's go home, Doug says into my hair.
You don't need to stay till the bloody end? He kisses my head again.
Not today.
You don't want to be part of the cleanup crew? That's when you'll get the best dirt on our new neighbors, I tease.
Nah, we're the guests of honor. Besides, whatever dirt there is, maybe we don't want to know. Maybe they can all just stay pristine.
He calls out, Thanks, everybody! You throw a hell of a party! A chorus of exclamation points comes back. Thanks for coming, and glad to have you in the neighborhood, and see you soon, and you've got to come watch a Giants game with us, and no, an A's game, and no, Giants. I behold the street, with all the industrious worker bees cleaning up and then disappearing inside their beautiful houses. I take in the banner they put up in our honor. I'm one of them. I'm home. A feeling comes over me, starting in my stomach. It tells me that all that light has to have a shadow. That all the camaraderie and the community could just be a mirage. A cover for something darker. That maybe the AV is too good to be true after all. That we've made a colossal mistake, and it's going to cost us a lot more than our life savings. No. This is just an example of what Dr. Morrison told me, that I have trouble believing I deserve good things. It took me a long time to trust Doug, and look how that turned out.
Chapter 3 Did you meet Tennyson? Really hot, and later in the party, really drunk, I whisper.
No, I met her husband, Vic.
Doug speaks at a normal volume. He says that's one of the benefits of having Sadie down the hall in her own room. I still wish her crib were at the end of our bed, like it was in the old apartment. I miss her like a phantom limb.
I met Vic just for a second, I say. He seemed like a nice guy. But what's with the clown outfit? And I hear he's the Easter Bunny, too. Oh, and Santa Claus.
Doug laughs, and I fight the urge to shush him. I'm enjoying the spooning and the talking. We're usually too tired to do much of it. But there's a bit of a disconnect in terms of our moods. Doug is in a state of pure, unadulterated happiness, convinced he did the right thing for his family by moving here. And I want to be where he is. I really do. Yet a tiny but significant part of me remains unsettled. I'm about to ask Doug if he noticed anything unusual about our neighbors, if they seemed just a little too friendly with one another, when he says,
My dad called.
Is it just coincidence that he picks that moment to roll away?
I should probably hop to it and call him back.
Now?
That's the deal, right? He calls, I jump, he adds. We jump?
It's only 8:30 at night, so it might not be that unreasonable for Doug's dad to expect a call back. But it seems that way to me. Meeting all those new people and trying to make a good first impression takes its toll. Any other parent would understand that, but Doug's parents don't have to understand anything. That's part of the deal, too. I haven't mentioned the note to Doug. I don't normally keep things from him. Well, present-day things. The past is a different story. I just don't want to tell him that I've already managed to piss off one of our neighbors. I'm pretty sure I figured out who wrote the note and why. First, the who. It's got to be Gladys. Someone who's that territorial about a parking space she doesn't even use obviously has a screw loose. The good news is, she's got to be 80 years old. She's harmless. She's a joke. At the block party, people were literally laughing at her. But it's my fault that her ire is targeted toward me. Since we moved here, I've been nothing but neighborly, except for that one time, that one lapse in judgment. Yesterday morning, barely morning, 4 a.m., I'd woken up from the chronic sleep deprivation and the stress of the impending party. You could argue I hadn't been of sound mind. I'd gotten out of bed carefully and creaked into the hall. I had to fight myself because the pull toward Sadie's room was so strong. Yet I knew that opening her door was likely to wake her and trying to catch a glimpse would just be selfish. Doug says that he and I need to have our intimate space back, that we've been living like roommates since Sadie. But I have so much tactile connection with her that I feel sated. I can't tell him that, though. It would be too hurtful. Sometimes I can't believe I've inhabited motherhood for only 4 months. This strange land with its own customs and vocabulary, sippy cups and breast shields and onesies, oh my. It seems like I've been living in disorientation, exhilaration, and anxiety for much longer. It's such a different love than I feel for Doug. He's fully formed, but I have the power to screw her up totally. These are the 4 a.m. thoughts. Once downstairs, I peeked out the window, marveling at the beauty of our neighborhood in the half-light. It was dimmer than that, actually. More like two-thirds dark. No one was out, and I assumed no one was up. I couldn't help seeing the 12 full garbage bags and untold pounds of cardboard that I'd broken down the day before, and that now rested against the front of the house, way too much to fit in the cans that Doug had lined up neatly along the curb. Doug's plan was to let all the garbage accumulate and then schedule a big pickup. "It'll be hauled away in one fell swoop," he'd said, doing an expansive motion with his arm to underscore the point. Wiped clean all at once. It was an appealing idea, but I was staring at an ugly reality. That's when I thought of the block party, and I went into a true what-would-the-neighbors-think panic. On this block, where everything is so geometrically neat, every hedge, even the garbage cans along the curb are precisely horizontal, I was gripped with fear. They were throwing us a party, and we were sullying their perfect neighborhood. We stuck out worse than a sore thumb. We were a dirty thumb. All the other houses dwarfed ours, and we had our own trash mountain, like it was Appalachia. Plus, Doug hadn't even set up the big trash pickup yet. He told me not to worry, he'd handle everything, but how could I not worry? Given his procrastination issues, when I add things to his to-do list, I never really let go of them. The item on my to-do list simply becomes, ask Doug if he's done X or Y. That's way worse than just doing X or Y, because it turns me into a nag. I'm not a nag, I'm a doer. June from next door had happened to mention that she hoped we were early risers because trash pickup was at the crack of dawn. So by the time everyone woke up, our trash mountain could be gone. The street was entirely still, with not even a drape twitching. Conditions were perfect. If the neighbors knew, they'd thank me. But I was sure they'd never know. I put a jacket on to conceal my pajamas and stepped outside. With a surreptitious look around, I walked over to Fanny's cans and lifted the lid. I felt a twinge, like it was a form of theft, that I was taking something that wasn't mine. I should ask permission, no excuses. But who was awake except me? If I waited to ask, I'd miss this week's pickup entirely. I was just so tired, and I could hear the garbage trucks rumbling blocks away. There wasn't much time to make a decision. If I was going to do it, I had to do it right then. I thought of the block party in our honor and first impressions. I needed to be good enough, to appear good enough. Decision made. With 12 bags of trash and untold amounts of recycled cardboard, I must have loaded up practically every can on the block. I remembered Tennyson and Vic had extra cans, which made sense given the size of their brood, and I tossed a bag or two in their auxiliaries. Raquel's can, for sure, and Wyatt's and Yolanda's, and who else's? Gina's. Brandon and Stone's, but they would never leave a note like that. June's cans were too full, which made me wonder how two people could generate that much refuse in a week. I stayed on our block. Nothing went in Andy's can. It had been too easy, and I'd felt lightheaded with success. Or maybe that was just sleep deprivation and lack of food. I'd been forgetting to eat lately. I even came up with a name for it. Distributing.
It was kind of like being part of the tiny house movement. Ridding the neighborhood of trash and doing as much recycling as I could. In that second, it seemed like I had discharged a civic duty.
Distributing?
Doug repeated when I told him later. He broke out in a big grin. He clearly thought it was nuts, but in a cute, quirky, Zooey Deschanel way. It made him laugh to imagine the neighbors catching me on my clandestine trash run down the block.
New mother skulks through neighborhood, clutching cardboard, he said, his fingers splayed out like it was a newspaper headline.
Wait. The realization dawns on me. I never used Gladys's cans. Does that mean the note couldn't have come from her? It had to have. Everyone else on the block is so nice, so welcoming. None of them could be behind such a stunt, even if my stomach just dropped trying to suggest otherwise. Anxiety craves a certainty it'll never get, Dr. Morrison once told me. But the majority of the time, the most obvious suspect is the right suspect. If a wife is murdered, chances are the husband did it. Or vice versa. Chapter 4. Do you think they actually liked you? My eyes roam the street for someone who's lying in wait, watching for the moment I'd find this next note on the windshield of my car. There's no one around. The street is as silent as it was at 4 a.m. on trash day. They've used another square of cardboard from the box containing the dining room chairs. I try to remember which recycling can got that particular piece, without success. I didn't commit that kind of detail to my already overloaded memory. Bandwidth is scarce these days, and it's not like I thought it would turn out to be a clue. I could understand the first note. It was a rebuke, telling me to keep my trash in my own cans. I assumed it was specific to an action I'd taken, one that I'd make sure never to repeat. This note is different, more global and yet more personal. It strikes at the heart of my insecurities, where I'm the most vulnerable. It's like this person knows me. I'm trembling. It's Monday morning. Sadie's already buckled into her car seat in the Outback, and we were going to try out a Mommy and Me class before our trip to the supermarket. I've avoided a lot of activities with Mommy in the title since my experience with the mom's group in my last town. But this is my fresh start. I make a snap executive decision to skip the class this week. It's better to go when I'm in the right frame of mind, so I can make the right impression. But there's no avoiding the supermarket. Hey, yoo-hoo, cat! I blink in the sunlight, startled. Tennyson is running across the street toward me, all legs in a pair of white silk hot pants and a short-sleeve silk blouse with a tie at the neck, almost like a cravat. I don't know how she can pull off that outfit or move that fast in 3-inch heels. I drop the cardboard and kick it under the car, hoping she won't see, hoping she won't ask. "Did you have fun at the party?" she asks. "Definitely." I try to convey the enthusiasm I felt before I saw that welcome mat. It was so great of all of you to do that for us.
Honestly, we were going to have a block party anyway. It's just great to have an excuse.
And we are extremely psyched to have the three of you here. Her hair is loose around the shoulders today, and she shakes it back from her face, smiling brilliantly.
Don't you just love when everything comes together like that? That's what life's all about. Synchronicity.
I try to agree heartily. I worry that I'm undoing all the good work I did at the party, that I seem awkward and strange, and my awareness of that only enhances it. Best to remove myself from this conversation as quickly as possible. Sadie's in the car already, I say. I should probably run.
Oh, sorry, I'll talk fast. There's a girls' night out on Thursday, and we want you to come.
She must see the question in my eyes because she begins to enumerate on her fingers.
Gina, Raquel, June, Yolanda, and Andy. We invited Andy for you.
Whoever wrote the note is wrong. They do actually like me. Sorry about the short notice, Tennyson says. We all thought someone else had already mentioned it to you at the block party and just realized no one had. It's like Kitty Genovese. You know who I mean, right? That woman who got stabbed in her courtyard with, like, 30 people watching from their apartments and no one called the police? The more witnesses, the less likely anyone is to call the police. She must see the WTF in my eyes because she adds, bad example. Anyway, once a month or so, we ditch the husbands and the kids. We just get to be women, you know? Sounds fun, I say. Let me check with Doug. Check with him? Just tell him. She touches my arm gently. We really want you there. Make it happen, okay? I smile. Okay. As she starts to cross back to her side of the street, she calls over her shoulder. Don't forget the rule, though. No talk about kids. It's a rule that instantly scares the crap out of me. I'm not sure what else I have to fall back on at the moment, but I'm almost certainly going to find out. If I turn down this invitation, I might never get another. When she's out of sight, I squat down and retrieve the cardboard. I toss it face down on the passenger seat and turn the ignition with my shaking hands. This is an opportunity, I tell myself. Tomorrow, it's Andy and Nolan. And Thursday, a bunch of potential new friends. This is why we moved here. It's going to be okay, I tell Sadie, using that lilting tone that she likes. But I can't hear any sounds in reply. I wish car seats weren't rear-facing so I could see her right now. She was asleep when I carried her out. It never ceases to amaze me what she can sleep through or what will wake her up. There seems to be no rhyme or reason to it. I can't stop myself. I reach over the seat and push back the fabric canopy that veils her. Spot checks make it more likely that she'll wake up prematurely and be fussy when we get to our destination, kind of how every time you change lanes you increase the odds of an accident. But in my present state of mind, I can't resist. I'm solely responsible for the welfare of this helpless, delightful, occasionally infuriating person. Okay, not solely responsible, but primarily. Doug leaves the house at 7:30 and doesn't get home until 7 o'clock most nights. The college generously allowed 6 full months of maternity leave, and Doug's parents have subsidized it financially with strings attached, as per usual. But I'm down to the last 2, the home stretch. I need to start visiting daycares, figuring out where Sadie will be safe, where she'll be loved in my stead. It's a painful thought, and maybe that's why I've been dragging my feet, despite the fact that procrastination goes against my nature. Many times I've questioned whether I'm equal to the challenge of motherhood. Her continued existence depends on me. How could anyone not be daunted by that, at least a little? Sadie had been sleeping, but with the sudden increase in light, she startles and cocks her head back to look at me. A spiderweb of drool spins toward her onesie, and she starts to howl. It's okay, sweet girl, I tell her. I move to stroke her hair and her face, but she's having none of it. It's like she knows that this awakening was completely unnecessary and at my hands. She doesn't want my ministrations. So, after a few minutes of trying, ineffectually, to soothe her, I reach into the diaper bag, remove the pacifier, and thrust it in her mouth. She sucks as loudly and contentedly as that baby on The Simpsons. I just hope she doesn't suck for as long. That show must be pushing 30 seasons by now. I used to fear that Sadie would become a pacifier addict, wearing one on a chain around her neck at college like she's at a perpetual rave. At first, I said she wouldn't use them at all. Then I said that it was just for when she needed to sleep. Now, all bets are off. It seems like I reverse myself all the time since she was born. When I used to say, I'll always do this or I'll never do that, it was because I didn't yet know how intolerable her distress would be for me, that it would shape my every action and reaction. I had no idea she'd be able to control me with her pleasure and, maybe even more so, her displeasure. The threat of her unhappiness hangs over me all the time, my own sword of Damocles. Trader Joe's is only a few minutes away, and I drive extra slowly, gathering myself. I manage to find a parking space close to the entrance. I decide that instead of using a cart, I'll snap Sadie's car seat into the stroller and just fill up the mesh bottom underneath. That's the quickest way. Shit. Where's the list? I forgot it. And that was before I found that note. That's just my normal mommy brain. I hate that expression, mommy brain. It's so insulting. But in my case, accurate. I remove Sadie's stroller from the trunk and then lift her car seat into it, waiting for the reassuring snap that tells me I've done it right. I wish life had more reassuring snaps. Just a split second of limbic soothing. Correct. Now proceed. I take a few deep breaths and then we cross the parking lot. Sadie's still sucking on that pacifier, a baby crack pipe, but I can't worry about that now. She's a baby. College is almost 18 years away. I've got more immediate things to worry about. No, I don't. It's just a scrawled note on some cardboard. But it wasn't scrawled at all. It was in a neat, even script, carefully printed rather than written in cursive. The person was taking her time. It wasn't the heat of the moment. It was a considered act, two considered acts, and that makes it much scarier. Twice is a pattern. Someone's holding a grudge. This is about trash, literally. How seriously can anyone take it? I will not take this seriously. I will not. The double doors slide open at our approach, and Sadie and I glide inside. I don't have my list, but my brain is working just fine. She's moved past rice cereals and loves the purees I make. I started with a small amount, just an experiment, so I'm ready to make a big batch, frozen in the special ice trays with their eco-friendly green lids, designed for just this purpose. I like having things match their purpose. I look around at the organic fruits and vegetables, hoping for sweet potatoes, since those are her favorite. I'm trying to smile at all the people who are smiling at Sadie and me, much more at Sadie, really, though it feels so unnatural, so counter to my emotions that I hope it's not coming across as a pained grimace. I put my head down and focus on the produce. If I don't see their smiles, then it's not unfriendly when I don't smile back. I hum Apron Strings, a song I love and fortunately one of Sadie's favorites, based on frequency of leg kicks. I toss a bunch of organic apples in a bag. Just fine. We are just fine. Hey, Katrina! I nearly jump. When I look up, it's Fanny. Damn it, I forgot to ask Doug her name. Beaming. Sadie is smiling back, around her pacifier. Oh, hi, I say with an extra wide smile that I hope appears genuine rather than clownish. Did you have fun at the party? It was the most amazing block party I've ever been to. Everyone's so welcoming and so kind. She nods, like she's heard it many times before, but it never gets old. I knew you and your family would be a great addition, she beams again. And how are you settling in? It's coming along, I say, trying to act normal. Do you ever seem less normal than when you're trying to act it? She adopts a sympathetic expression. Moving is just about the most stressful thing there is. And with a little one? Even one this precious? She's doing sort of a baby talk thing on the last sentence, directing it at Sadie, which Sadie seems to appreciate. Yeah, it's been pretty stressful. Made more so by some neighbor who chooses to remain nameless. Would Fanny have a guess who it is? No, I can't tell her. She might wonder what I did that was so unneighborly to begin with. Well, I should finish the shopping. I need to get Sadie home and down for her nap. That's it, she says with approval. Stick to a schedule. It's the thing that keeps you sane. She pauses to cast an adoring look at Sadie. I raised my girls in this neighborhood and watched it change around me, but only in good ways. What ways? The property values have gone through the roof, obviously, but it's just stayed so accessible. I think that's the right word. If anything, it's only gotten friendlier. People truly want to know each other.
Another pause.
Everything about each other.
Her face turns so thoughtful, it's nearly grave.
The AV is a very special place, Kat. You'll see.
I try to tell my tightening chest. That wasn't a warning. It was a promise that there are good things to come. I've arrived. Before I can think of a proper response, she's walking away.
See you soon,
she says gaily. Sadie and I get through the rest of our shopping trip without interference. Once we're home, I decide to take the old advice. Nap while your baby naps. But I've never been able to do it when she's in her crib. I need her flush against me. We lie together on the love seat, my feet dangling just a little off the edge. Good to be only 5'4" when you can't fit a full-size couch. Sadie is pancaked to my chest, and we breathe together, slowly, deeply, hypnotically. Doug and I talked about having Sadie nap only in her crib so she's used to being on her own, but I'm just not ready to be on my own at the moment. Doug would understand if I told him about my morning, about getting a second note. But I'm not going to tell him. Better to let him be my distraction, to let his spirit of optimism and his presumption of a world worth trusting suffuse me.
Crudité again?
He asks that night as he drops into a kitchen chair, grabbing some of the cheese I've cut up and sticking it on top of a cracker. He doesn't actually mind, or if he does, he's never said it. I didn't only cut up cheese, but some vegetables, too. It's a balanced meal, sort of. I'm a lot better than I was earlier. After our nap, Sadie and I took a bath together, read books, listened to music, and I don't even know what else we did, but the hours passed, and most important, we didn't have to leave the house. It was just the two of us. Even when it's good with Sadie, even when she's not having any of her outbursts, there's a pressure, I feel, to keep things good, for her to remain happy. It's a low-level hum, the pressure, like having a bug burrowing in your ear canal. Listening to that all day can suck the life out of you, though I never want Sadie to feel my lack of energy. If she did, then how could she stay happy? When Doug comes in, the bug dies, just like that. Sadie's in her high chair, and I'm feeding her the last of the puree cubes. I'll have to make the new batch tomorrow. No excuses. My breasts are heavy with milk. I missed my last pump session. It's not that I was sleeping or that I forgot. It's that I just plain didn't want to hook myself up to that god-awful machine. It doesn't hurt anymore. My nipples are inured. But having to occupy Sadie in some way for 15 whole minutes while I'm indisposed, holding the breast shields to my nipples, seemed especially onerous today.
How was Mommy and me?
Doug asks. I didn't go.
Why not?
I shrug. That's not the same as lying. I was tired.
You skipped class for no reason?
You say skipped class like I was going for my PhD. It's Mommy and me. We were going to sing Old MacDonald. I'll go next week. I think I'll be able to catch up. He pops another cracker in his mouth.
Someone's touchy.
Just tired.
You know what might help?
Some relaxation. He drawls out the word, and I know he's not thinking what would help me. He's thinking how long it's been since we last had sex. I play dumb. After we put Sadie down, you want to start a new show? We could have a Netflix marathon. Whatever. His tone is mild. I want to tell him about the notes. I can't tell him about the notes. Because either they're about the trash, in which case I'm to blame, or they're about something else, where the question of blame is much more nebulous. No, they're just about the trash. I have to believe that. And soon, the writer will get a new hobby and leave me alone, and no one will ever have to know the rest. Not even Doug. Especially not Doug.
Session 1. You're a doctor, right? So you can prescribe medication?
I have a doctorate in clinical psychology. So yes, I'm a doctor. But no, I can't prescribe medication.
I was told you're an expert in trauma. Are you?
It's one of my specialties, yes.
What are your other specialties?
Would it help you to know that answer? Or do you think maybe you're a little uncomfortable being here and you're trying to delay? That's a perfectly normal thing to do in a first session. It's a perfectly normal thing to do, period. No one likes talking about their pain.
I'm not perfectly normal.
I imagine you want what we all want. To be valued. To connect. I know you've been through a lot, but you have the same needs and desires as everyone else. It's all about how we fulfill them.
That sounds profound.
Are you being sarcastic? It's okay if you are.
So everything's okay in this room?
Emotions are okay in this room. You just need to learn the healthiest ways to express them. My job is to make this a safe place for you. But I need you to tell me how to do that.
I can't tell you that. I can't even tell you the whole story.
I know from your intake form that the trauma happened when you were a child.
I'm not even sure it's a trauma.
Let's take a step back. Slow down and start over. What brings you in today?
I want to feel better. I need to get over what people have done to me.
That was then, and this is now. You didn't have control then. You have it now. You just aren't convinced of that yet.
And your job is to convince me?
No, it's to cede control to you. We go at your pace. You pump the brakes when you need to. You tell your story the way you want.
Why do I feel like you're doing some Jedi mind trick on me?
Let's take a step back. Slow down and start over. What brings you in today? Why now?
My whole life is a mess. I thought I'd gotten away from my past, but it just keeps shadowing me. If I'm not careful, I'll fail out of school, and I can't seem to be careful. I just can't seem to care.
Yet you care enough to be here. That's huge.
It doesn't feel huge.
How things feel isn't necessarily how they are.
Are you always going to talk in riddles?
That wasn't a riddle. That was as straightforward as it gets.
Chapter 5. It's 3:23 a.m. Doug hasn't built my desk yet for the nook. So I'm huddled over the laptop, which is open on the coffee table. I'm studiously ignoring the affront to my sense of order. Book boxes that still need unpacking, the pictures and coat hooks and mirror that haven't yet been hung on the walls. And that's just the living room. Instead, I peer at my screen, where I'm logged into Homestore, and right next to it, our credit card. Homestore received my return 3 days ago, but the refund hasn't shown up on our Visa yet. We could use that $107.46. I've turned off autopay on all our bills because I need to keep a strict eye on what's going out right now. In more than 10 years of having a joint checking account with Doug, our balance has never been anywhere close to this low. It frightens me to look at it. So I stop looking. I click on my to-do/to-build/to-install file, taking note of the satisfying check marks beside what's already done, though I haven't entered a new one in days. I also keep a tally of when back-ordered items should be arriving, as well as replacement parts. Every time I go into Sadie's room, my eyes involuntarily travel to the half-built dresser. Doug can't finish it without Part C. I'm pretty much obsessed with Part C. It's become a running joke with Doug and me. "When's the Messiah coming?" he asked the other morning. "You know, Part C?" I laughed, but he could never truly understand what it means to me. He grew up in comfort rather than chaos, in attention instead of disregard. Part C is a repository for all my anxiety, a symbol of my great desire for Sadie to have better than I had, for her to grow up in a home that's child-proofed in every sense of the word, with someone thinking of her well-being first, always. Things half-built, haphazard, disorganized, or dirty remind me of how I was raised. Doug certainly doesn't know everything, but he knows that much. I'd logged out of Visa, but I'm still logged into Homestore. And almost against my will, I find myself clicking on my wish lists, room by room, though outside isn't technically a room. For such a small house, our yard is large, and it's in need of mowing and weeding. That's on the TD/TB/TI list, too. Someday, I'd like to be able to buy the child-safe fire pit I've saved to my list, and some furniture to surround it. A bistro table and chairs for the deck for sure. A hammock. A papasan chair. That's the life we're going to have, where we relax and we entertain legions, with kids and dogs running around, chasing bubbles until they're satisfying pop. Doug wanted us to have more people over when we still lived in our apartment. He has plenty of friends that he doesn't get to see nearly enough. But I didn't want to entertain. I just wanted to be with him, drinking $15 cocktails in ambient bars and restaurants to put me in the mood. I didn't even like the bartenders to recognize us, so we rotated. Not being known is one of the best parts of city life, as far as I'm concerned. But that was then. This is now. Doug and I are no longer a couple. There are already three of us. So, the more the merrier. That's supposed to be my new motto. I keep trying to put my anxiety over the notes to rest, but it continues to surface. It's probably because I have so much trouble resting myself. If only I could sleep, the world would look so different. I close my eyes and I see the handwriting. It's so neat. That's a person who means what she says, who could wreak systematic havoc on someone if she so chose. There's nothing overtly feminine in the handwriting, yet I can't help thinking that caring about violated garbage cans and writing catty anonymous messages is something only a woman would do, that it's a particularly female strain of domestic passive aggression. Maybe it's because the professional world feels a million miles away right now. Because I spend my days sweating what I know to be the small stuff, while Doug, i.e. men, is off immersing himself in masculine productivity. At least, that's how it is in the AV, where it seems like Tennyson is the only one with a job outside the home. Has motherhood paradoxically turned me sexist? Consciously, I know Doug isn't working harder than me. Being a stay-at-home mom is far more taxing than any other job I've held. And what's more important for society than raising a child well? Somehow, though, my daily life feels insignificant. My tasks, like that of a worker ant scurrying back and forth, holding a single crumb aloft. The truth of it is, sometimes I don't know who I am anymore. Without the accoutrements and accessories of my former life, without all that was automatic and assumed, without the tether of familiar routines, I'm unmoored. I grab onto Sadie and I hold her tight, because otherwise I might just drift off into open water. I'm so tired of worrying. About being a good mom, about fitting in, about the stupid notes. I'd love to wake Doug up right now and have him reassure me that I'm doing a great job and it'll all turn out fine. Better than fine. We're AVers now. I tell myself the things he might say, but they ring hollow. I head for the stairs. It's time for me to fess up about the notes and be reassured. But something stops me before I reach the first step. It's an old friend. Shame. I'm ashamed that I brought the notes on myself, and ashamed that I'm getting myself so worked up. Doug has always thought I'm a little bit fragile because of my childhood, and he doesn't know the half of it. Doesn't know an eighth of it. Dr. Morrison heartily disagreed, but a part of me still feels like I brought things on myself with Layton, too. In sessions, she encouraged me to call him Layton, not Mr. Layton, like I was used to calling him in class. Or Steve, like I called him outside of it. Just Layton, my abuser. A pedophile, she said. I didn't want to disappoint her, but I couldn't attach that word to him. I still can't. I do what I always do when thoughts of Layton rise to the surface. I make myself busy. Settling back on the love seat, I check my email. The top one is from something called goodneighbors.net. Andy Prager invited you to join. Andy's up at this hour too? I would never have guessed, based on her visage at the block party. She looks like a woman who gets her beauty sleep. I click yes on the invitation. Instantly, another email appears. Register now to find out what your neighbors are up to. We're going to Andy's house tonight, so I feel obligated to start the sign-up process. I don't want to reject her this early in our relationship. I click around Good Neighbors, getting a flavor for it. People are talking to strangers, correction, neighbors, about sheds they need built, the best piano teacher for a 3-year-old, a free bicycle that just needs a new front tire, how to plant tulips, and where they can find a non-toxic dry cleaner. It's all stuff I would have turned to Google, Yelp, or Craigslist for, but this is about going local and building a community. There are potlucks and more block parties coming up. Girl Scout cookies are being sold on the corner of Vine and Bedoin. We're new to town and have a 5-year-old. Anyone going to the park today? Is a typical message. People are hungry for connection in a wholesome 1950s way. It's not quite city because of how trusting everyone seems, and not quite suburbia because people actually walk and know their neighbors, and because Main Street has only local businesses, no chains allowed. It's trans-urban, like Gina said, a high-tech Mayberry. I haven't even uploaded any kind of profile, and the messages are already pouring in. Ty and Linda welcome you to the neighborhood. Brandon and Stone welcome you to the neighborhood. Which one's up, Brandon or Stone? June welcomes you to the neighborhood. June next door? We're a block full of insomniacs. Is there something in the water? Garrett and Maya welcome you to the neighborhood. And of course, Andy and Nolan welcome you to the neighborhood. Good Neighbors wants me to introduce myself. I should say where I'm from, why I moved here, what my interests are. I'm exhorted to upload a pic. Since Sadie came along, my photos are of the two of us, and I'm not especially pleased with how I look in any of them. I don't have any recent pictures of Doug and me. Who would take them? Sadie? And I'm not the selfie type. I think about uploading a picture of Sadie alone, but would that make it seem like I'm uncomfortable with my appearance, or obsessed with my daughter, or both? It could say that I have no identity outside of her. Besides, it could give potential predators ideas. Predators who'd know, vaguely, where we live. I skip that step and fill in the text bubble. Since Andy's the one who recruited me, I don't want to reflect poorly on her, if anyone can see our linkage. Hi, neighbors. My husband Doug and I just moved here with our new baby. Can't wait to meet everyone. It couldn't be more bland, and really, 2 exclamation points in 3 sentences? But at least it won't give too much away or offend anyone. It's the Hippocratic Oath of the new neighbor. First, do no harm. Immediately, my mind goes to the one person who's not afraid to tell me that I've done harm. But that's one person, and I've got a whole neighborhood welcoming me with open arms. My generic profile message has already garnered 12 likes. I have girls' night out on Thursday. Andy stopped by the block party just to invite us to dinner. I wish that last bit soothed me, but I feel the opposite. Andy's overtures make me nervous. She seems like the kind of person who'd already have a life overpopulated with friends. So why is she pursuing me? Chapter 6. I can't believe I'm about to knock on the recessed door of this massive stone Tudor. In grays and browns, with tall, narrow, multi-paned windows, it actually has side gables. You could fit 5 of our house inside, comfortably. But it's not just about the fact that Andy and Nolan have so much more money than we do. It's that they're in a different developmental stage altogether. This is a house where adults live. We, on the other hand, live in Crayola. Doug thinks of our new home as a member of the family, and he insisted it should have a name. He likes naming things in general, so I told him to go for it, and he did. And now, Crayola was the obvious choice, given our primary color scheme. I want to tell him not to call it that in front of Nolan and Andy, but I can just imagine the hurt that would shoot across his face. Besides, there's something incredibly sweet about the pride he takes in saying each morning before he leaves for work, "See you back at Crayola?" When we first got married, he never just said, "This is Katrina." No, it was, "This is my wife, Kat." He was proud of me, the way I'm proud to present Sadie. It's one of his most endearing aspects.
"What's going on?"
he asks, sensing my hesitation. "We're just such small potatoes."
"The Pragers are big potatoes. King Spuds."
That's a name that will stick, I can tell.
"See you at the King Spuds," he'll call out.
That's if we make it to a second hangout. The night is still young. Noticing my fidgeting, Doug tells me,
"You look great."
I don't know that I believe him, but it gets me to ring the bell. Andy opens the door immediately, like she's been waiting just inside for us. The whole place is filled with this almost religiously golden light, reflecting off the yellow walls as if we're entering a monastery. The entryway flows into the living room, and there's mahogany wood everywhere. The floors, the railing, the exposed beams. The living room has an imposing brick fireplace at its center. There are orange velvet wing chairs and a green velvet sofa, heavy draperies, and what has to be a real Persian rug. I'm not sure I like it, but you can't help but respect it. This is a serious house. You wouldn't know that a baby lives here, except in the living room where I see the same vibrating chair from our house. So they shop at Target, too. They also have one of those jumperoos we've been meaning to get. Both look laughably out of place. I finally realize that Andy's been talking, and fortunately, Doug's been talking back. She ushers us inside. Andy's even more petite than I remembered, dressed casually in jeans and a brightly patterned button-down shirt. She's holding Fisher in her arms. He's in a striped sleep-and-play that has a touch of Riker's Island to it. She's got some sort of orange puree, carrot, sweet potato, in her thick strawberry blonde hair. She's a hands-on parent, apparently, though she doesn't have to be, and that makes me warm up to her and let my guard down. That and her smile. She's freckled and dimpled, and despite her house, there's something down-to-earth about her. Sadie is gazing at Andy with fascination. I give her chin a wipe with the burp cloth. Fisher has begun to squirm in Andy's arms. He's a blocky kid with dark eyes, very little hair, and surprisingly brutish features for a baby, like Andy's got a future schoolyard bully on her hands. Nolan walks in. He's short, 5'7" or so, and older than Andy. She looks my age, mid-30s, and I'd peg him as mid-40s at the youngest. He's dressed identically to Doug. North Face fleece, jeans, and high-tech running shoes. They both start laughing. I can't help noticing that Doug is much better looking and a good 5 inches taller.
"Can I get you two anything? Coffee, tea, Perrier, beer, wine?" Nolan offers. "We've got a great Pinot. We bought a case of it on our last trip to Napa."
"No, thanks," I say. Andy is making faces at Sadie, who is giggling. Sadie never calms down unless something has stopped or started. Something has to change. Like when Andy takes her attention off her and she lets out a sudden wind.